You are tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago. Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company and the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Come to the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. In beautiful Hyde Park, 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is where serious readers go for fun. Enjoy a wide selection of titles in a unique space that's perfect for browsing. Specialties include literature, mysteries, children's books, cookbooks, and travel. The Newberry Library Bookstore at 60 West Walton carries a distinctive selection of books, cards, and gifts in a beautiful landmark setting. Specialties include Native American studies, history, genealogy, cartography, calligraphy, and music. And the Seminary Co-op at 5757 South University Avenue, across from the University of Chicago Quad, enjoys a reputation as one of the best academic bookstores anywhere. Known for the breadth and depth of its inventory, the Co-op carries more than 100,000 titles in a wide range of disciplines. Visit the Seminary Co-op bookstores in person. Call toll-free 800-777-1456 or look up semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Martin Amos, whose book House of Meetings will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Oh. Well, thank you. And now settle down, people. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm host and producer Victoria Lautman. We are live at Looking Glass Theater, currently on the set of their next play, The Wooden Breeks. You can't tell if you're listening to this from the radio, but we're basically on the set of a graveyard with an open grave. I hope that does not bode ill for this interview. Anyway, thank you all. We'll be taking a break a little later. You'll also get to hear questions at the end of the show, and I'll announce our upcoming schedule. But first, the most important reason that we're all here. Ever since Martin Amos published his first book in 1973, at the tender age of 24, that was The Rachel Papers, he has gone on then to write 9 more novels, 6 works of nonfiction, 5 collections of stories, essays, over 400 reviews and critiques. He's basically the Energizer Bunny of the international literary world. He just keeps going and going. He has been one of the most celebrated, influential, and even controversial writers, particularly in England. Here he is merely celebrated and influential. In England, he is a cultural force who has been recognized by cab drivers and pharmacists. His life and every move and every book and article published is greeted with a sort of frenzy of publicity that would make Paris Hilton and Kevin Federline weep with envy if only they could get that coverage. During his 3-decade-long career, Amos has had praise heaped upon him. His book, Money, Suicide Note, was in fact just selected as the 2nd most important novel in Great Britain in the last 25 years. But he has also endured some of the most vitriolic, apoplectic critiques you have ever read. So that a man who can, for instance, be cited routinely as brilliant or a stone-solid genius has also been called, this is one of my personal favorites, Britain's uncrowned emperor of loathing and unofficial poet of human self-disgust. And that's one of like the nicer ones. This must be hard to listen to. Anyway, Amos is, of course, the son of the esteemed writer Sir Kingsley Amos, who died over a decade ago and is the subject of Amos Jr.'s memoir, Experience. If you've never read it, it's incredible, mesmerizing. He's here to talk about his 10th novel, House of Meetings, and we are extremely lucky to have him here. Thank you. This is a book that starts out in 2004 with an 86-year-old narrator who goes unnamed, looking back on his life for the last 40, 50, 60 years. And it has been billed as a love story, primarily a triangular love story. But because of the nature of the material and the people that are in the book and the way the story unfolds, that seems to be very simplistic to me. How were you describing this book to people when you were in the process of writing it? What would you tell people who hadn't read the book that it is actually about?
Before I answer your question, I'd like to thank you all for coming in this terrible weather. In fact, are you nuts? what are you doing here when you could be watching TV at home? But this is Chicago, and one of my proudest possessions is this jacket, which used to belong to Saul Bellow. And when I was coming in from the airport, the jacket trembled with with recognition that we were back in this city he described as filthy, brilliant, and mean. So I expect Chicagoans to get up of bed on a Sunday morning and brave a blizzard to come and hear a writer talk.
Have we only hit brilliant so far? We haven't gotten to like dirty and mean yet.
Filthy and mean, no, we haven't got that. How would I describe this book? Well, I used to refer to it as my gulag novella. But then it grew and stopped being a novella, and at a certain point, very definitely it became a novel. But I do find it, I think it is a love story. But the main love is between the brothers. They're half brothers, but you know, the woman is vitally important, and they both love the same woman. But it's the relationship between them that seemed to me the main thread of the book.
If people had read your earlier nonfiction book, Coba, The Dread, Laughter, and the 20 Million, which tackled the same period in history from a nonfiction perspective, it might lead them to believe something different, that that was the only time that you wrote a nonfiction book about a subject that you then went on to write a fictional book about. You've covered other subjects like the Holocaust, like nuclear annihilation, in this kind of form, in a novel. But this is the first time it felt almost like you were trying to scratch an itch. You didn't get out of your system, I guess, in nonfiction form. What was it that you had to go on and do?
Well, it's happened to me a few times, not at novel length, but you look into a subject as a journalist would or as an amateur historian would, and you write a discursive piece that's to do with facts and figures and opinions. And it's happened to me before, 2 or 3 years later, you find that it's trickled down into your unconscious. Journalism and essays, that's all conscious mind. That's all front brain. Fiction is much more mysterious and comes, you don't know where it comes from, but it's you don't arrive at your decisions about fiction with conscious thought, with ratiocination. It just occurs to you. And I found I had more to say and could say it. Any question you ask a novelist that has the word decide in it is not quite right, because it isn't a question of deciding. It's nothing appeals to you about the book you're writing except the fact that you can write it. And you feel, here's a novel I can write. It's been given to me, and I can write it. And that's all you need to proceed.
The material that you used in learning about this period, and you were really immersed in it, people called you obsessed with this period of the Soviet experiment and the Gulag and the slave labor camps that function as an important part of this book. But the idea of using that as a setting for a love story means something, to present it in a way that is just sort of the cold hard facts or even the memories of people you were quoting, that there was something about that period and this place that you had to get to through these two brothers and the woman, Zoya, that is at the center of both of their affections.
Yeah, well, the moment of, you know, what Nabokov called a throb, when a novel arrives, a throb which, as Updike said, is then immediately followed by a million points of resistance. That moment came for me when I was reading Anne Applebaum's History of the Gulag, recent book, Gulag, A History. And this is mentioned in Solzhenitsyn, but not dwelt on. But she has three pages on the House of Meetings, which is, you know, unbelievably, it was a kind of holdover from the enlightened post-revolutionary culture, where, for instance, you know, you could get divorced by sending someone a postcard. Abortion was legalized. The family was weakened. It was sort of, you know, modernist and progressive. But in the Gulag, they had conjugal visits. You know, ridiculous. The idea that you'd be enlightened in the Gulag. And valiant women would travel for weeks, sometimes months, across, you know, 9 time zones and up into the Arctic Circle, beyond the Arctic Circle, to spend a night with their husbands. And these visits were almost always disastrous, partly because they would have been persecuted too, as would all your family, as members of the family of an enemy of the people. And sometimes the women were coming to say that the children had been adopted by the state and she was divorcing you. And I think an absolute basic was a display on the man's part of impotence, because you were anemic with malnutrition and the hormones weren't being produced. But also, and perhaps most centrally, you know, the House of Meetings is by definition a house of partings. And after one night with your wife, you had the re-entry into the slave system, you know, it all resuming, was often more painful than coming to the camp in the first place. And what really moved me was the memory of a Polish prisoner who said that when these men came staggering out of the House meetings and for weeks didn't talk to anyone and found it difficult to eat and so on, he said, although everyone was very humanly reduced in the Gulag and very coarsened and brutalized by it, that no one ever mocked or ridiculed these men, and their suffering was respected in silence by every prisoner. Most surprising little throb of warmth in this wasteland.
In the book, you actually introduce us to the House of Meetings and describe it very minutely before we even get to the point where it becomes significant. The time in the book is very interesting, elliptical, it goes backwards and forwards. And actually, what I'd like you to do is read now from the point after you describe the House of Meetings to when you describe Lev, the half-brother, and his first day in the camp in Norlag, where the narrator, who goes unnamed, has already been there for several years before he sees his brother show up.
Right, sure. just get these on. As you get older, you not only get balder and bulkier, but also blinder. Don't forget blinder. which is perhaps just as well. Yeah, I read the other day about a new mental disease called dysmorphic apprehension syndrome, or perceived ugly disorder. This is where you look into the mirror and see something much worse than the reality. And that's what I hope I've got. I'm not kidding. Getting older is like a you find yourself auditioning for and then starring in a coarse, irresponsible, and above all, low-budget horror film. Where they're saving the worst for last. Yes, Lev has come to camp. My brother Lev came to Norlag in February 1948. I was already there at the height of the war between the brutes and the bitches. He sees him arrive at night, and then the next day he sort of creeps up on him. They're half-brothers. They have different surnames. So Lev's first day, he would spend most of it with the medics and the work assigners, was also the monthly day of rest. I came up behind him in the yard. He was sitting on a low stone wall where the well used to be, his knees pressed together, his shoulders sloped forward. He was cherishing his fractured spectacles and trying to believe his eyes. And what did he see? The thing that was hardest to grasp was the scale, the inordinate amount of space needed to contain it. In his line of sight were 5,000 men, 10 times that number lay to the sides, beyond, behind. When you got used to that, you had to come to terms with the evident fact that you were living in something like an army base, where the conscripts had been drawn from a direly indigent madhouse, or a direly indigent hospice. In your nose and mouth was the humid breath of the camp, of Norlag, and, more distantly, the fresh cement of the brand-new Arctic city, the monumental denture of Predpozilov. And finally, you had to absorb an assent to the ceaseless agitation, the mad dance of the stick insects, the nervous fury of the zoner. I said, "Don't turn around, Dmitriko." Never again would I call him that. It was not the time for diminutives. It never was the time. A camp administrator who allowed two family members to set eyes on each other, let alone meet and talk, let alone cohabit for almost 10 years, would be punished for criminal leniency. On the other hand, we would not need to be masters of deception, I didn't think, to avoid exposure. We were half-brothers with different surnames, and we were radically unalike. To be brief, my father, Valery, was a Cossack, duly de-Cossackized in 1920 when I was one. Lev's father, Dmitri, was a well-to-do peasant, or kulak, duly de-kulakized in 1932 when Lev was three. The father's genes predominated. I was 6'2", with thick black hair and orderly features, whereas Lev... It seems that I'd better describe him now, your step-uncle. This is addressed to his 24-year-old black American stepdaughter who lives in Chicago, where he ended up when he defected. Your stepfather, to prepare the ground for the thunderclap that is barely a page away. There was something yokelish, indeed almost troglodytic, in the asymmetries of his face, the features thrown together inattentively, as if in the dark. Even his ears seemed to belong to two completely different people. Say whatever else you like about it, but my nose was unquestionably a nose, while Lev's was a mere protuberance. And when you looked at him side on, you thought, is that his chin or his Adam's apple? He was also, as a kid, short, meager, and sickly, a stuttering bedwetter in inch-thick glasses. All he had was his smile. In the mess of his face lived the teeth of a beautiful woman, and his rich blue eyes, the eyes of an intelligent, definitely an intelligent. I said, "Don't turn around, and when you do, show no pleasure in seeing your older brother." And the younger brother immediately tells him that he's just married the woman that the older brother is in love with.
Martin Amis reading from House of Meetings. It's a bombshell that Lev has married the woman, Zoya, that the narrator has been in love with and lusted for and waited for, and who is kind of at the center of these men's relationship. But the irony that brought Lev to the camp, I think, is fairly amusing.
He is
brought there because of basically a verbal misunderstanding.
Well, it's never said why the narrator is there, because... often there was no reason at all. It was just done by quota. So important to understand what the gulag was. When people say Guantanamo Bay is America's gulag, it shows fundamental misunderstanding of what the gulag was. It was a slave system. It was meant to terrorize the population, which was already terrorized, but it was slavery, and it was state slavery, and it was meant to be profitable, and it wasn't. Where were we?
We were talking about why Lev ended up there, the Americas.
So the narrator's there just on a quota, and the terror, they kill people by quota, too. He's there, the charge against Lev, the younger brother, is praising America, which was an offense with many sub-categories like praising American technique or abasement before the West, all these sort of things. You couldn't mention America without... As they say, American, Russia, the same. In America, you can dispraise America, and in Russia, you can dispraise America. But in fact, he wasn't praising America. He was praising the Americas, and that is their nickname for this woman. She's so called because she's a full figure, and is wasp waisted, and is also very unsteady on her feet because as a child she never learnt how to crawl, and certain readinesses and reflexes aren't there. So she looks like the Americas on a map. Her waist is Panama. Her ass is Brazil, you know. And he was praising her, and someone in a, you know, food queue, one in ten of everyone was an informer, reported him anonymously. You didn't even have to sign your letters of denunciation. And off he went, 10 years.
The relationship between the narrator and his brother is it's so troubled and so poignant. They obviously love each other. They can't bear each other. They are constantly kind of at each other for various things. And all through the book, the book actually lets us see what happens to both of them. It doesn't cut off. You do get to find out the denouement of everybody. Although you've written it in a fairly cliffhanger sort of style, which I don't remember from any of your other books, there's a lot, because the narrator is writing to Venus, his African-American stepdaughter who lives in Chicago, he's constantly explaining to her how his life has unfolded and who these people were that she essentially never got to meet.
Yeah, but that, I can't tell you how important it was that that sort of structural device of having the whole thing addressed to the stepdaughter, Venus. Because I floundered around for months trying to write this book and didn't have... She was in the book, but as a tiny minor character, Venus, just one scene. And then suddenly I realized that he... Of course, he's... I kept on asking myself, why is he telling us this? And then by having the whole thing addressed to Venus, there was suddenly... It solved every problem I was having because it gave a reason. He's sort of giving his apologia for his life to his stepdaughter. She's the most important person in his life, and it also gives him a plausible reason for explaining things, because he's never talked about all this with her because it's too painful for him. So, you know, this holds the book together in a vital way, and once I'd established that, it came much more easily.
Why was it important to you that she be a black American?
Well, I mean, it's very important in the book that she's black.
Because of the connection to slavery, because of her understanding of that?
Yes, because she knows in her blood, she knows what it means to be a slave. He's got to confess to some terrible things. I mean, he killed people in the Gulag, and he as a soldier in the Second World War, in 1945, he raped his way across what would soon be East Germany. And he says he expects her disapproval, because she's rather politically correct. Not that you have to be politically correct to disapprove of rape. But he says, don't, you know, if you are going to, you're going to disapprove of me, but make it personal, Venus. Don't do it, you know, with your group, with your ideology. Do not exercise zero tolerance, you know, a policy that suits those who favor zero thought. You know, make your own response. Don't have the response of the crowd, of the herd. And he does something even worse later on in the book. But, you know, he points, the mitigating circumstance is 4 years on the dirtiest front of the dirtiest fight in history against a rampant Wehrmacht, which has come across the border to wage a war of extermination against Russia. And it's killed 25 million of his countrymen and destroyed everything he knew. So the fact that they raped German women, you know, and there were apparently a million children born from this rapist army that came into Berlin. At the end of Stalingrad, as the German general was surrendering, a Russian general said to him, looked out at Stalingrad, it was a complete ruin. And he looked out and he said, one day Berlin is going to look like this. And if you think that there aren't, you know, savage impulses of revenge and that these things do have a context and you do have to use your historical imagination to understand them.
Then why is it, or how is it, I can't use the word decide, but the structure of the book is carrying us along and carrying Venus along as it sort of wait till you hear what happens next. There's a letter, which we know he's carrying. It's 22 years old. It's from Lev, written after his soul-destroying, basically, house of meetings event with Zoya. But he doesn't read it for 22 years. We know it's coming. It's the kind of denouement of the book. And you very much want us to keep following it is like a cliffhanger in parts. You just have to keep turning the pages.
Yeah, I mean, he has the letter for 22 years, but he only knows he's not aware that he has it in his possession for 21
of them. Well,
that's true.
Okay, but we know it's coming.
No, but I mean, this is Russia, and often when I thought this motivation's a bit thin, or that's a bit odd, and then I think, he's Russian, you know. you don't have to do that motivation stuff, you know, he's just Russian. the real key core of this book in my sensibility is reading Dostoevsky in my teens. And Dostoevsky's terrific for when you're feeling all nihilistic and scowly and 17 and you're full of lassitude and disgust and nothing looks as though it means anything. And now you get Dostoevsky, whose characters are all, you know, screwed up on purpose, you know, as if life wasn't tough enough. He's described in this book as Dostoevsky, that old jailbird, windbag, and genius. And reading him now, he's fantastically crude, Dostoevsky. The only good quality he has is that he's a genius. He hasn't got any talent. but nonetheless, all those perversities, this Russian curse, Russian sourness, the way the Russian seeks the most difficult position, the worst of all possible outcomes. In the background of the book, we're describing Beslan, which is his journey back to Russia is in 2004, and the days he is there, Beslan is unfolding. And he says, why is it that we already expect the worst possible outcome? Why, and this is Russian heavy-handedness, and why is Russia so heavy-handed? Why are its hands so heavy? And the best explanation he can give is that, Russia's so vast that it has to have this heavy authoritarian center, rather like a galaxy has to have these black holes in the center of it and all this dark energy and dark matter policing the tug to the center so to stop it flying apart. So throughout its millennium of history, there's never been any freedom, any responsibility for a Russian individual. And this breeds a kind of anarchy within so that you do behave perversely because you don't know what it's like to have normal cause and effect in your life. You know, it's never been like that. And we now see that it's really hardening up again. And I know Russians who think that, it's in the book, that who think that Beslan was the work of the FSB. It wouldn't have been direct. It would have been Putin saying in his Aesopian language, we need an event in North Ossetia to strengthen our resolve for the war in Chechnya, strengthen the resolve of the people. It's been more or less established that those airplanes and apartment houses that blew up were blown up by the FSB to get some fever going for war in Chechnya. And that's what the state is like, you know. And every Russian doesn't know, you know, conspiracy theory is your basic there. And all they know is that the reality is even worse than it looks. That's all you know for sure.
Well, the narrator keeps referring to his Western eyes versus his Eastern eyes, and I think that really crystallizes it. We're actually going to take a break now, but in cliffhanger mode, we will be back soon with more from Martin Amis and House of Meetings. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
As Victoria said, this is 98.7 WFMT Chicago, and you are listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now, this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space perfect for browsing. And the Newberry Library's bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456 toll-free or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. If you'd like to be in the audience for our next broadcast of Writers on the Record, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book House of Meetings with its author, Martin Amos.
Welcome back, Writers on the Record. I've got Martin Amos here talking about his new book, House of Meetings. But I also want you to mark your calendars. We have Alice Hoffman, February 25th, Anne Lamott in March, Anchi Min in April, Arthur Phillips in May, and June is still up in the air, but I'm trying. Anyway, this House of Meetings is Martin Amos's 10th novel. The 11th is already, I think, pretty much in the works, and there's a four-book deal going on. But as you've just been hearing, House of Meetings takes place largely in the gulag of the Soviet Union, but rockets back and forth from 2004 to 40, 50 years earlier. We get to meet this narrator who, for all intents and purposes, is just a brutal, wretched, you know, impossible human being who seems incredibly cold. He's a decorated rapist. He's admitted to things all through this book that just make your blood run cold. But, you know, frankly, by the end of it, you have such sympathy for this man. He actually has shown heart and soul in a number of places in ways that you don't expect, not just because of his writing to his stepdaughter with the kind of love that you see, but he really knows what he's lost. He yearns to go back to the man he was in 1941, a man who was sensitive and stood up on the train to give his seat to a woman. And he has a moment in the camp where, in spite of everything, the people he's murdered there and brutalized, he feels extreme love when the folks at Norlog actually unite together in solidarity. So there's a kind of a redeemed quality in this man by the end of the book.
Yeah, that's a reference to the rebellion that did take place. There were a series of rebellions after Stalin's death where they just stood there and the tanks came and they just went on standing there. Well, he does yearn for the man he used to be, and as the younger brother says, they took away the men we were going to be. That's almost the essence of the crime. You know, it's often said that memoirs of the Gulag are unrepresentative because they're all written by intellectuals and not by criminals and guards. You know, that it's just this one stratum, the politicals, but they're deeply unrepresentative in another way, too, I feel, in that You know, these people like Solzhenitsyn and Yevgenia Ginsberg and Janusz Bardak, what enormous souls they had, you know, what incredible spirits they were, what amazing force of life they had. There was a very popular tattoo in the gulag sported by the hereditary criminals, the Yerkes, who were like circus strongmen, you know, with gold teeth, and their families had been criminal for 3 or 4 centuries. The most popular tattoo read, "You may live, but you won't love." And this book is really a dramatization of that. But these Solzhenitsyns, they lived and they loved, you feel, and their integrity was never challenged. And the person they were going to be, you know, Solzhenitsyn said, prison has wings, you know, it makes you, you can soar in prison. Very underrepresentative in that sense, and I think, you know, most of the millions who passed through the system, tens of millions who passed through the system, had a fate more or less like these brothers, that their integrity did not survive. Their character was ruined. They couldn't love. They lived, but they couldn't love.
Would you read from sort of the last third of the book, where we actually focus on the narrator and what happens after he leaves the camp, this period where he can no longer love, but we hear a little bit more about his life post-camp.
That's right. It's just a little glimpse, but... you need to know that he in his relationships with women, he develops, as he said earlier, this... I know several men who have this, but I've never had it, but retrospective sexual jealousy, where you, you're obsessed by their past boyfriends. And, you know, you sit your girlfriend or your wife down every night and said, you know, go through it all again, and he touched you where? You know... You kissed his what? And there is a sort of explanation at the very end of what that might mean. His brother, Lev, immediately goes into a steep decline when he comes out of the camp, doesn't work, you know, lies in bed all day and complains of nightmares. And I did better. Living in corners, this is the phrase where you might have one family in each corner of a room. Living in corners at first, I poised myself on the northern brink of the capital and went in every morning on a 7 o'clock train. Very soon I had money. In 1940, there were 400 television sets in the USSR. In 1958, there were 2.5 million. Every single of them, one of them, belonged to a CP party member. Dealing with the TV sets of the nomenklatura, this was my day job and my night job, installing them, repairing them, or simply clearing up after them, because they frequently exploded, even when they were switched off, even when they weren't plugged in. I would soon indulge in an extravagance, the purchase of my certificate of rehabilitation, a considerable expense in those years because Russia had not become, or had not yet gone back to being, a bribe society. But I spoil myself. When I went away, I was 26. I was getting on for 40 when I came back. Gluttony and sloth, as worldly goals, were quietly usurped by avarice and lust, which, together with poetry, yes, poetry, consumed all my free time. I mixed with the black economy crowd, and my girlfriends were of a type. I suppose it would be accurate to say that they were of the type of the croupier. They were veteran molls and flappers, with excellent heads for business. And in my dealings with these women, Venus, I ran into a logistical problem which would trouble me more and more. Take one at random. The inventory of her body and its abilities would, of course, be paralleled by the inventory of her past. And her past would be long and gruelingly populous. And they were still walking, these women. You see, by that time, hardly anybody was getting killed. And I had to know about them, all of them. So I would often find myself prolonging a hopelessly soured romance, sometimes doubling its duration, just to make sure I'd winkled out that rugged smuggler from Vladivostok, that sleek bijouterist from Minsk. Between 1946 and 1957, I ate two apples, one in 1949 and one in 1955. Now I went to however much trouble it took to eat an apple every day. The man who usually sold them to me knew that fresh fruit was something of a delicacy in the Soviet Union, but we had completely different ideas about what an apple was. If the queue, in the queue there were currents of recognition and mistrust, if the line was 50 Russians long, there would be 7 or 8 who had been away. There would be another 7 or 8 who had helped put them there. I would meet the eyes of men and women who agreed with me about what an apple was. I ate everything, the core, the seeds, the stalk.
Thank you. The dates in this book are specific. He specifically mentions 1941. He specifically mentions 1956. And I realize in going back and looking at your memoir experience from 2000 that those were precisely the dates when your father, Kingsley, was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. How much of your interest in this was about trying to understand his connection to it? I know you had famous conversations and disagreements about it.
That was very much at the heart of the nonfiction book, Cobra the Dread. I was fascinated by this difference between my father and me, and we have so much in common, but not that. I'm non-ideological, and he was. He's in 1956, after Hungary, the failed uprising, he stopped being a communist, but he didn't start being a sensible person. He became a fanatical anti-communist. And anti-communism is an ideology like any other, and get you into ideology-type disasters, like Vietnam, for instance. And I wondered what it was, because he was more of an individualist than me, and didn't care at all what people thought of him, and loved being unpopular and all that sort of thing. And yet he needed this, you know, what is an ideology? It's this sort of brotherhood, this Umma, where you have all these common souls that are that you all feel the same mass emotion, you know, it's sort of weird thing. Always violent too. All ideologies are violent, including especially religion. And the reason they're violent is that they involve illusion, and when this illusion, this ideology is challenged or affronted, you can't defend it with work of mind. So your fists have to tighten because you can't justify it otherwise. So you immediately have the violent reflex. So when I was growing up, I lived in a communist household until I was 7. I don't remember any terrors or famines or mass arrests or anything of that kind. And then thereafter, he became sort of a God. We became a God-fearing liberal labor household. But he had the mirror image ideology growing in him from then on.
He was famously problematic as a father. And although when you wrote the experience, the memoir, you came out with a different view of him. And I think people almost like cut you some slack for the first time in many years because they got to see a side of you and a side of your relationship that was very different from what people had thought before that. But he was basically cruel in the way he treated you and your work. He only made it through 3 of your books.
No, this emphasis is completely wrong. I mean,
really?
I've only now beginning to see just how rare it all was that Christopher Hitchens said he said he'd never seen a father get on so well with his children, particularly me. Because we had a sort of literary friendship too, but also with my brother and my sister.
No, but what about not so much him as a father, but as a reader of your work?
Yeah, but I mean, let's get the emphasis right.
Oh, sorry.
That it was.
That's what I was thinking in my head.
Yeah. Unbelievably good relationship, and completely. All my friends have very difficult relationships with their fathers, and I think that generational flip and twist of that era had to do with. Basically, the father being sexually jealous of his children and enforcing that jealousy in the guise of being high-minded. You know, they were very old-fashioned. You've got to remember just how old-fashioned that generation was. But my father had already had that war with his father and didn't give us, was the most permissive and encouraging father in that way as it was possible to be. And indeed took us out and bought us a gross of condoms each on our 15th birthday. And was not lewd or anything, but just sort of tremendously didn't put any obstacle in the way of that. So, yes, he was a bit cruel about my writing, but, you know, I was a big boy by then, and there was a bit of a shock at first. But he wasn't the sort of man who could, you know, I'd tell a white lie to protect a relationship about someone's work. But he was constitutionally incapable of being dishonest about writing. And he didn't like my stuff. He thought it was too fancy. And
he's always throwing it across the room.
Well, he did throw one across the room, it's true. And couldn't read the one that was dedicated to him. But he did. He read Times Arab, the one about the Holocaust, and he enjoyed that and was generous about that. And so that sort of made up for it. But compared to, you know, the good things about the relationship, it really wasn't central. And it's quite wrong to think that that's what we were all brooding about. It wasn't.
By the way, if anybody's interested in asking a question, this is a good time to come down to the microphones. Don't worry about making noise. We'll have a few minutes for questions at the end. Entering into the family business of writing is a complicated thing. And there are so few father and son relationships that went on. Maybe you can think of Auberon Waugh, maybe wrote one book afterwards. You continued, you were kind of nipping at his heels in a way that obviously annoyed him, and he spoke publicly about that. And you eclipsed him, so that by the time he died in 1995, your reputation was at a much higher level than his reputation was, I think. Oh, no, you don't sneer. It's true. Everybody says so. It's not my opinion. I read this about you. But so yeah, my question.
He did once say, he said, I was at a party last night, and a woman came up to me and said, "What's it like having a son who's more famous than you are?" And I said, "What do you say?" And he said, "He's not more famous than I am." And the woman said, "Yes, he is much more famous than you." And he thought that was funny.
Oh, and he was so annoyed by how much money you made, and was always like ratting you out about.
No, he wasn't.
That's... Come on, it's in your book.
No, it's not. It's not in my book.
Okay, it's somebody else's book.
Not true. He says in his letter, a letter to Larkin, he says Martin made £29,000 last year. The little shit. But that's an affectionate, you know, affectionate, envious. I mean that's nothing. You know, you want to hear him on people he really doesn't like.
Well, I guess what I was getting at is you have said that you felt strongly that literary ability was something that was strongly inherited. And you have five children from three different parents, three different mothers. And what if one of them decides that they're going to be a writer? Is this something that you think is a gene you've passed on? And how will the third generation of Amos writers...
It's a horrible thought, another generation of nightmare writers. Well, actually, it isn't very strongly inherited, is it? Otherwise, there'd be more cases of it.
Well, I was wondering why you said that.
Yeah, I was wrong. Music, yes. Painting, yes. But not the written arts. I think that may cease to be true. And already the girl who won the Booker Prize, her mother is Anita Desai. So there are many more writers around, so it's going to happen now. But, what would I do? I would do what my father did, in that I wouldn't give them a word of encouragement, because that sows awful trouble. And I know a world-famous writer who encouraged his son to be a poet and took him around the literary editors' offices, including mine, and said, "You're going to be a great poet," to a kid who was 15. And there are no prodigies in poetry. You know, the youngest ever is Baudelaire, 18. And how can you possibly... You're saying to your son, "You can have my life." And after, about a year later, he sent me some poems at the New Statesman where I worked. And the first line was, "My dad is a bastard." And they've hardly exchanged words since in 30 years. I mean, tragic. But don't do it. Don't whisper about the possibility that they, you know, that they're equipped. It's not like taking over the family pub. You know, it's you stand alone, and it may make things a little bit easier for you at first, but it'll make things more difficult for you later if your father is or your parent is.
I believe that. It's hard enough having a parent. Okay, are you scared to ask questions? Get over there. And in the meanwhile, while you're making your way to the microphone, okay, this is perhaps mean-spirited of me, but I thought it was very funny, that sometime in the 90s, I mean, the envy and vitriol aimed at you in England, it's very different from your what happens when you come here, where you're simply very respected. People just, you push a button in England. And in the 80s, when I think it was particularly strong, I think it was The Observer that had, I may be wrong about that, but anyway, there was a contest for a title that was the most unlikely book title ever, and the winner was Martin Amis, My Struggle. People really do see you as someone who just had everything dropped into your lap. And I think that's why when you wrote Experience and people realized how complicated and full of tragedy and difficulties your life was. I mean, you had, you know, maybe not more than the average person's fair share of trouble, but certainly your fair share of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, everyone has their fair share. And suffering isn't relative, as Shaw said, you know, that the suffering you have is as bad as anyone's suffering. You know, it looks more extreme elsewhere, but you suffer as much as you can, you know. you never say to yourself, I'm only suffering a bit, do you? I mean,
well, you might suffer now. We have some questions for you, please.
So, you have unusual for Western writer attachment and knowledge of Russia. Nobody, as far as I know, writing books about Russia from Western writers. So my question is, why is this? And secondly, what do you think about current Putin regime after, like, Litvinenko, Polonium?
Do you mind if he doesn't answer that part of your question? Just so we don't go off into politics.
Yeah, it could be short.
Right, well, I think actually I would have agreed with you a couple of years ago, but I think many writers now are turning to the Soviet Union. And I think it's the same reason that there was a spurt of books about the Holocaust about 10 years ago. And the hinge event is that the people who suffered in the Gulag are now, there aren't many of them left on the face of the planet. And out of decorum, it may have been you stay silent until they're gone and you don't feel qualified to speak. But once they're gone, it loosens the subject up and you feel you can come at it from odd ways. And suddenly it's not a violation of their suffering and their past. And so I think we will see more novels about Russia now.
Thank you.
My name is Keith. The first novel that I read of yours was Dead Babies, and I have to say that I had a lot of resentment or building within me as I read that book because of that character. I've jettisoned that, but I just wanted to know a little bit about the genesis of that character, Keith, and perhaps your attachment to that name, because I believe you have another character.
Yeah, Keith Tannant in London Fields.
Right.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid I'm sort of neurotic about names, and I wrote a piece about Tim Henman where I said he'll never win Wimbledon because of his name. Not because of Henman, but because of the Tim bit. No Tim has ever done anything in the history of the world. It's because when they were little, people say, hello, Timmy, and it sounds so like timid. And actually, the Tims are stepping forward now, and there are lots of Tims distinguishing themselves. It's the Tims are bouncing back, you know. But as for the Keiths, the future does not look bright for the Keiths, but they may surprise us yet.
Let's take Maybe we have time for one more question. Yeah, thank you. I hope your name isn't Tim or Keith.
Good afternoon. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between, I guess for better terms, personal violence and institutionalized violence in this book?
I can say that that they are intimately connected. Violence is our big trouble, isn't it? It's look at history. It's we're not a peaceable or a rational species, but violence is a kind of category mistake. I think it's someone at some point put it about that violence was a good way of achieving things. And in fact, it's a terrible way of achieving things, and it doesn't achieve things. And as was said about the Soviet Union, means define ends. So something that's put together violently can never last, because that's the spirit with which it's erected. And all that just melts away and is part of the ruin of time. You know, it doesn't last. Things achieved by violence don't last and are answered by more violence, and it is. It's a cliche to say, the cycle of violence. And we see, we're sort of struggling to evolve out of this. And when we look at the Middle East, where this incredible experiment in cruelty is being conducted in Iraq, where people are tortured before death and then mutilated after death, you can say that, we're reluctant to say that we're morally better, but we're morally more advanced. And a century and a half ago, Americans were lining up and shooting each other to pieces and scalping each other over the right of one faction to have black slaves. I think we've come on away since then. There's a sort of moral wealth that comes from evolution, and this is the thing we're trying to grow out of, this completely self-defeating use of violence.
Thank you. Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and I guess there's just a couple. Well, maybe you can tell us this. You've got your next book basically in the can. I think it's finished. The Pregnant Widow.
Not quite finished, but yeah,
maybe, this weekend.
Yeah.
But that's the start of a new 4-book deal for you, as I understand it.
No, I don't think so. I mean,
I'm going to send you my press packet.
Yeah.
So you can read about yourself.
Well, but I mean, 75% of everything ever printed about anyone is untrue.
Is there a book coming out?
The Pregnant Widow is far advanced, and I'd like to explain the title. It's the Russian thinker Alexander Herzen said that it really means feminism in the case of this book. But he said whenever there's a revolution, a cultural, political, social revolution, one ought on the whole to be braced and pleased to see that one order has replaced the other. He said, but then he went on, what you don't get, though, after a revolution is a newborn child. What you get is a pregnant widow. And the father is dead, but the child is not yet born. And he says there'll be much trial and tribulation before you hear the infant's cries. Now, the sexual revolution sort of happened in 1970, basically. That, if I had to choose a year zero, it would be that. But it's not a question of snapping your fingers and saying men and women are equal. Even in, the best bit of your mind, it's not like that. And it has to roll through villages, all this, before you see its final form. And I'd say that feminism is about halfway through its second trimester.
We'll see it born sometime. They're saying 2007. Oh, I didn't get to ask you about the new sort of political writing that you're doing, and your story, The Last Days of Muhammad Atta, was, I thought, fascinating. Again, stirred up all the controversy we expect. That was one of the novellas or stories that was meant to be part of the original trilogy that House of Meetings was meant to be. But you can't talk about that now because we're out of time. So when you come back, when you're traveling with The Pregnant Widow, I hope you will come back and see us here at Writers on the Record.
Any excuse to come to Chicago.
Thank you very much, Martin Amis.
people at the Maven Chronicles and at the Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. If you'd like to be in the audience for the next discussion and broadcast of Writers on the Record, please call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft, House Sound Matthew Cameron, Director of Production Alex Blunt, and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Mary Mazurek is today's audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Today's broadcast was made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. You are tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago.